Chapter 16, Playing Dress Up. June 2006. The fit models walked into the showroom one by one to line up in front of us. I looked over at my mom and she was beaming. Next to her was Beth Plyler, my old dance teacher, whose smile widened with each model's step. My mom was the president and the creative director of the Jessica Simpson collection, while Beth was brand manager. "The stitching on that one," I said, pointing at one shoe. "Let's make it tonal," my mom and I said at the same time. We laughed. The collection was a godsend for us. Starting a fashion line was my mother's dream, one she had held on to since she was a little girl. My great-grandmother, who had a sixth sense, used to watch my mom cut paper dolls to dress them up in scraps of fabric. She gave my mom a deer foam slipper box to keep them in. "This is your dream box," she told her. "One day you're going to be a fashion designer." "What's that?" she remembered asking. She always styled me when I started out, and during newlyweds, people would contact her to give me clothes to wear. Mom noticed that what I wore on the show would then sell out in stores. Since everyone was always asking my mom what I was wearing, she wanted to cut out the middleman. She told my dad to find someone willing to do a licensing deal so we could just make the clothes ourselves. One thing that was important to us was that whatever we did had to be affordable. I had a shawl, a simple cream one, and the girls constantly asked me where I got it. It was from Barney's, and I felt bad telling them that because the price tag was out of reach for a lot of my fans. I wanted to give them the feeling of luxury without having to spend a lot of money. Dad put out feelers and approached Vince Camuto, who became our fairy godfather. He was a footwear legend who had created Nine West, then sold it for about $900 million. Vince was a suave but kind mastermind who first learned what women really wanted to wear when he was a poor Lower East Side kid who had started out as a cobbler and then charmed his way to the floor of a store on Fifth Avenue, selling to rich New York City ladies. When my dad approached him, Vince was nearly 70. And I think he was too busy working to know me from MTV. He asked his son John, who had seen me on Newlyweds, what he thought of me. "I'd bank on her," John said. And my life changed. It only took one dinner with Vince and his beautiful wife, Louise, for all of us to click. I talked about my own passion for dressing girls going back to childhood, when I styled everyone for prom and I would sometimes pick out clothes to buy myself because I knew it would also look cute on one of the girls in the youth group. I'd lend them out and it made me love the piece even more. With Vince, I was adamant that I could make clothes that could appeal to all women. "Not everybody has the body of someone who lives in New York or Los Angeles," I said, and Vince smiled. "I want to sell to the average girl because I love that girl." Vince had built an empire on footwear, but he didn't just want a shoe license with me. He saw the potential for a lifestyle empire. Vince paid me $15 million for the master license, and people thought he was crazy. "Jessica really is America's sweetheart, and I think her fans will grow with her," he told Women's Wear Daily when we announced. "If this is not a $1 billion or $2 billion brand, I'll be shocked." He built a 7,000-square-foot showroom for me in the Macy's flagship store in Herald Square in New York, and then went to Italy to find these gorgeous chandeliers and white marble fixtures to put in the showrooms in both Macy's and the Southern chain Dillard's. It was a sign to the customer and to me that this was a serious venture. My mom created an office for her and Beth right over the garage of her house. She was at it almost every day, creating the color palette and picking out materials and fabrics. Beth helped with logistics, and we gradually involved more family friends, still keeping the operation tight. We started the line with shoes, specifically a high-heeled red cowboy boot that cost $69. With Vince, everything was for the love of shoes. We all wanted to make money, too, and we did right away. But Vince showed me how important it was to put your heart and soul into the sole of the shoe your customers are walking on. The cowboy boot sold out immediately, and we brought in $50 million in wholesale goods the first year alone. As we expanded to denim and sportswear, then handbags, home, and accessories, my mom and I hired designers in every category. We would collaborate with them in an initial design meeting, suggest the color palette and styles that we thought should be a part of the brand. The design team would then go do their magic and come back for a second mid-design meeting where we would see mock-up samples so we could make tweaks and changes. From there, we would have a final design meeting where we see the finished samples that would be making their debut on the market. That's where we would pull the pieces that just didn't work and add finishing touches to the collection. My mother could execute ideas like none other. She brought all the efficiency and penny saving of a preacher's wife to her new calling. Then I would do 8 or 10 hour days at the showroom, either approving or tweaking the designs. I have an attention to detail that sometimes drives me crazy, but while being a perfectionist is hard, when it comes to design, it is so rewarding. If I asked for a change, I would remember the next time I saw the piece. I think people were surprised by how involved I wanted to be. I trusted my mom with the keys completely, but I still like to get in and drive every now and again, which is what I was doing that day in the showroom. One of the fit models was new, a cute girl with long brown hair pulled back. She was willowy and graceful and kept turning her heel to better show the shoe. "Would you buy it?" I asked her. She paused, her eyes widened. This happened with the new models every time. They were so used to being treated like mannequins by designers, so they didn't expect that I was genuinely interested in how they felt wearing the shoe or the accessory. The fit models make the rounds of all the showrooms, and they know the quality of other people's stuff. I want to know if they will wear the shoes. And can they actually walk in them? "You're not hurting anybody's feelings," I said. "We're in these meetings to fix things. You'll still get paid if you hate the shoe." "I like it," she said. But I'm tall," she said. My mom and I looked at each other and did a quick nod. I'm on the shorter side, so the higher the hill, the more confident I am. I tell people I live on stilts, but I needed to translate my preferences to make something for everyone. "Maybe we should take the heel down an inch," my mom said. "Half inch?" I begged. 3/4, she said and laughed. "That work?" I asked the model. She smiled. "Yeah," she said. "Then I totally wear them." I put my fists up in triumph. "Sold," I said. It was interesting to see my mom in action. This was her calling, something she could work on with me that didn't involve my dad. Until recently, my mom was very shy and always turned down magazine profiles and generally refused to walk red carpets with me. This was all hers. This was what they lived and breathed. Fashion wasn't my dream, though of course it's been fun. My payoff was always making people feel beautiful and confident. That moment the model smiled. The bigger girls I'd meet who thanked me for not making plus-size looks that were only about covering up. Curves should be glorified. People think they need to hide a mom bod, but that body literally built a life for someone else. I want all girls to put on my looks and have 5 people telling them they love their outfit. It is why our fit models have a range of body types and why I never diet for my ad campaigns. If I am 10 pounds heavier, then I'm 10 pounds heavier. Sure, it helps I have control over the shot and I get to choose the photographer, so there's trust. But once I was handed the reins of the Jessica Simpson collection, I could just steer the business where my mom and I wanted us to go. A lot of celebrities crash and burn with clothing lines, mainly because they let their pride get in the way. They either try to sell something that isn't like anything in their Dior stuffed closet, so it is out of touch with what is truly wearable, or they try and do super high-end sample sizes at $400 each. I don't need the price tag on something with my name on it to be high just so I feel fancy. I might buy that stuff, like a lot of that stuff, and I respect it, but I don't need to sell it. You have to let go of your ego in this business. I always say, people can walk all over me as long as it's my logo on the bottom of the shoe. Another reason I've succeeded when other celebrities haven't is one small but very important decision I made when I signed. A non-compete clause. I didn't want Vince to be able to sign any other celebrities without asking me. I am not giving up my floor space in department stores so some pop star or reality TV person can launch a line. The point is that you must take care of yourself, even when you're given an amazing opportunity. My mom could ace the bar exam if she took it tomorrow because she's read so many contracts. I just Google the words I don't know, she tells me. You need to nurture your dream the way you would a best friend or child, and you need someone you can trust on board with you. I am beyond grateful to my mom for all she put into this brand. You've been listening to me talk, so I want to hear from you. Press pause for a second on your life and ask yourself, what is my calling? What makes you feel passionate? If you don't immediately have an answer, try broadening beyond something specific. My mom's was specific, fashion, but mine was more broad. I like making people feel good, whether I'm doing that through music, which came naturally to me, or through writing, which is harder on me but brings a different reward. I'm driven by the same impulse. I think sometimes we get so caught up in the vessel of the work rather than what matters, the spirit that fills it. While I was in that showroom, I had a secret. I'm sure as soon as I left, I texted him. I first met John Mayer a year before at a February 2005 party Clive Davis threw during Grammy weekend. He ran up to me and told me how much he loved the song I wrote, With You. We were on the same label then, Columbia, so he would randomly show up at events like my album release party. What the F is John Mayer doing here? Nick asked me then. I didn't invite him, I said. Nick didn't trust him, and he probably shouldn't have. John began to write me immediately, and I was flattered but only interested in him as an artist. He was about 2 albums into his career, but everyone could tell he was a singular talent as a guitar player and songwriter. His notes quickly became more intimate, and he told me he saw something in me that no one else did. He asked why I would want to just be famous as a wife. He said I was so much more than what the world perceived me to be. As soon as I was single, he made his move, and this time I was interested. In the summer of 2006, I was still dating and using those relationships to figure out who I was. There were a few guys with big hearts and strong personalities, and I found myself changing to suit them. John wasn't having it and told me he wanted to have all of me or nothing. He assured me he didn't want to make me into anybody else. Early on, he wrote a song about me. He made it so plain that I thought, oh, he does want me to be myself. So I chose him. Casey felt uncomfortable with my decision to date John. I always saw Casey as my friend first, but she was always very professional as well. John was a Columbia artist, and she knew John from even before he signed. She had already been put in the middle of the situation with Nick, and she didn't want to go through that again. But Casey was also uncomfortable with a lot of my decisions back then. She was worried in my rush to start my new life, I was losing the girl she had first met. She quit being my assistant, telling my father first and then offering to help train a replacement. I'd grown so dependent on her that I felt like she was leaving me. I felt abandoned. Our friendship was strained for quite some time. John and I dated in secret for months, with dinners at my house and meetups in hotels. My security team would lead me through a back entrance of a Soho hotel, then up a shabby service elevator. When he visited me, he would have his hood up, but he wasn't on the radar of any paparazzi. John was a night owl like me, both of us unable to turn our brains off. He said that I had kept him company in the middle of the night with my proactive infomercials. In the beginning, there was give and take. I saw him combing his hair and told him not to bother, that it looked better wild, like a dark romantic hero. He would ask me for advice on outfits, and just seeing him wear something I picked out made me feel proud. He saw me writing in my journal and left a note in there for me. If I wrote you a note, would you read it? It began, the sureness of his jagged handwriting so different than my world. I was in love. It seemed mutual. Again and again, he told me he was obsessed with me, sexually and emotionally. The connection was so strong that he made me feel seductive, and he spoke about sex and my body in a way that made me feel powerful, at least physically. His focus on me was the opposite of my marriage. I would get up and go to the bathroom, and John would ask, "Where are you going?" While I was married, my ex-husband couldn't be bothered to figure out what city I was in. It felt safe to be so desired. I knew John would never cheat on me, and that confidence was a new feeling for me. Where I felt insecure in the beginning was that I always felt that I was falling short of the potential he saw in me. I constantly worried that I wasn't smart enough for him. He was so clever and treated conversation like a friendly competition that he had to win. He would get going, riffing from one subject to another so quickly that I would get lost. One minute he was explaining the start of his Rolex collection, and then another he was going on about a collector who he was jealous of, then the nature of jealousy, then the construct of time and the heft of it on your wrist. When I tried to leap back in and say something to add to the dialogue he was having with himself, he would challenge what I said because that's how he saw the give and take of conversation. Sometimes he wouldn't let go of questioning why I thought a certain way until it had me second-guessing myself. I'd get quiet, take another sip of alcohol, then another, and wonder why I couldn't just sit on a couch with him without getting so anxious. I even asked one of my girlfriends who knew him for advice just based on her speaking to him. It was the start of a bad habit. Asking people who were not dating John how to date John. "You have to be a strong person to make a contribution in the conversation," she said. "You can talk to him about anything because he just wants to learn about stuff. You don't just have to talk about what you think he wants to talk about." So I spoke about what mattered most to me and what I was most confident in, my faith. He found it fascinating, but of course he would challenge me on what I believed. I think he envied that steadfastness, because it was one of the few things in life he couldn't quite figure out. But I could only do that so much. My anxiety would soon take over, and because I'm such a sensual person, my solution was just to give him love. The mix of sex and love was the easy part, because I had plenty of both to give. We were able to see each other in secret throughout the summer and the start of my campaign to promote my album, A Public Affair. As opposed to Nick, I wrote a fun album, an 80s radio throwback that was an ode to freedom. Not one single song was about him, even though people assumed the cover I did of Patty Griffin's Let Him Fly was directed at him. It was my way of assuring myself that I needed to let go of Johnny Knoxville. I was proud that I had writing credits on 10 of the 13 songs. The first single was A Public Affair, and when it came out on June 29th, Billboard called the first single a perfect record. It did fine numbers, but it was clear when I tried to promote the record that people weren't ready to see me so happy after my divorce. The album came out August 26th, a month before John's release of his album, Continuum. I got the highest first week sales of my career, but the numbers fell a lot immediately. That album was never going to do as well as In This Skin. Still, I was excited that John and I had albums coming out around the same time. We loved that we had this amazing secret we had kept. And then we didn't have it. The week of my release, someone from my team broke the story to the tabloids. Coming just a week after my album came out, it looked like a full-on amateur stunt orchestrated to sell both our albums. I fired the person. John was worried that he seemed in on it and felt that his artistic integrity was in jeopardy. I was in New York, and he exploded on me, breaking up with me over email. On August 31st, he posted the cover of Public Enemy's Don't Believe the Hype on his blog as a response to the media. I was humiliated and thought he was out of my life for good. He wasn't. Still, I was trapped in the middle of promoting an album. I had hired a new PR agency and clicked with Lauren Auslander, who would later become one of my best friends. She was my age and understood what I was going through. I was lucky to have her with me through that tough time. The initial conversations with reporters were already a pretense to get to their "what about Nick" questions. And now I had to play dumb when asked about John out of respect for him, too. I didn't lie. I just said he was a musician I truly respected and that I had known for years. I left out that he had put me on a pedestal and kicked it over on his way out the door. There was one bright spot. The breakup was right before the MTV Video Music Awards. And one day I was in a VMA swag suite at New York's Bryant Park Hotel. A swag suite is where they give celebrities things they didn't need so they will become walking advertisements for products. I won a silver 2007 Chrysler Crossfire luxury sports car, a two-seater paparazzi magnet. I wasn't really surprised, since of all the celebrities there, I was the one most likely to have a photo with a car featured in the tabloids. Maybe because I was so depressed, I wanted to make something good happen. I had stayed in touch with the Casa Hogar Alim Orphanage, which I had first visited 9 years before. With the money I'd made, I was able to help Mama La Pizza make the place a comfortable home for the kids. Not just running water and electricity, but basketball courts and bands to take the kids to school. Doing my part helped me realize that I was blessed and reminded me that God had given me this grace. I didn't take it for granted. It seemed ludicrous that I was getting a free car now. I also knew that the week before, Mama La Pizza's van had broken down and now she was using a beat-up old truck. I dutifully took photos with the car outside, giving the camera a look of shock as I held the key fob. When it was done, I motioned to the Chrysler rep as I took off my sunglasses. Is it okay if I swap this for a minivan instead? I whispered. She looked at my stomach. Why would you need a minivan? I'm not pregnant, I said, rolling my eyes. It would just work better for me. They gave me a white 7-passenger Chrysler Town & Country, which I later drove through the gates of the orphanage to hand the keys to Mama La Pizza. The kids knew I was coming and saved up money selling bracelets and necklaces so I could have a mariachi band greet me. Everyone was in clean red t-shirts, except for a few of the tinier girls, who had brightly colored dresses on. I lifted one girl when she hugged me, and we danced around to the music. I was truly happy. And at least for that moment, no man could take that from me.